Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
Nick Gowing is an award-winning journalist and news anchor specializing in foreign affairs. He was the leading news anchor for the BBC World News for 18 years, having previously worked with the Independent Television News. His career has included extensive coverage on global events and crises, making him a trusted voice in journalism and winning him two BAFTA awards. This decades-long career has afforded him extensive experience in reporting on diplomacy, defense, and international security. Using this experience, in 2014, he founded the Thinking the Unthinkable Project, which seeks to assist leaders in understanding the threats posed by our turbulent and rapidly changing world. Nick, thank you very much for being here today and agreeing to participate in this podcast. We're very excited to have you as our guest. You and I, of course, had many exchanges during my time as chief economist at the World Economic Forum, for instance, in the BBC World Debates you organized in Davos. And you always impressed me with your remarkable familiarity with the main issues of the day. Let me start by asking you something that I am sure you have been asked many times before. What is thinking the unthinkable, and how does it relate to the current disruptions that we're seeing around the world?
Thank you very much, Augusto. Well, thinking the unthinkable, of course, was what Herman Kahn warned about with the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 61, 62. So it's not an original phrase, but it's something which, when I was leaving the BBC by my choice, I have to say, no one forced me out, back in 2014. It was when Putin was doing dreadful things in eastern Ukraine, and then went on to annex and seize Crimea as well. And I, with my many years of experience, getting on for 35 years of experience on the road, including all the revolutions in Eastern Europe, what happened in the Soviet Union, with the end of the Soviet Union, and also, I have to say, with the departure of Soviet troops from Afghanistan, and I was in the shipyard strikes in Poland back in 1980 with Lech Wałęsa. There are pictures of me standing in black and white film, the gates there. I say that because, not to boast about it, but to say I could feel that something was changing, not least the way in which Putin was essentially saying, I want to seize another country, which, of course, goes against all the principles of international law, all the principles which we've all been working for and assuming would be an improvement to world economy, world politics. It was essentially two fingers to the norms of which we've all been working for and assuming would happen. And also the arms control treaties were becoming unraveled and so on. And I therefore could feel that something big was happening. The old normal was disappearing to be replaced by what? I have to say, though, Augusto, that most people thought I was nuts. Most people wondered what I was smoking. I encouraged my colleague, Chris Langdon, to come and join me. And we embarked on a research project, seeing off essentially the waves against us. And we, back in 2016, we predicted the Brexit would take place. We predicted that Trump would be nominated and elected. We predicted a lot of other things which have now come to pass. But people still could not believe why we were saying it and what we were saying. And it is, therefore, thinking the unthinkable, but really also more aptly, thinking the unpalatable. It's about looking at the data, looking at the evidence, and even if it goes against your better instincts, realizing that something is changing. And that's what has happened with COVID-19 in the last 2 years. 2 years ago, and we're recording this in late November of 2021, 2 years ago at this time, it was virtually unknown, maybe worries in China, but no one was prepared to foresee the enormity of disruption which COVID-19 was about to create. But we've had 20 years change in 20 months, something no one was prepared to really consider. And now we're heading for the climate emergency and the enormity of the implications. As Bill Gates says, we can get a vaccine for COVID-19, but we can't get a vaccine against the climate emergency. And I would put to you, even at this stage, Augusto, the unthinkable, which is really the unpalatable, is the enormity of change that all our lives are going to have to go through in order to be able to cope and hopefully somehow keep the increase in world temperatures to 1.5 degrees. We've all got massive changes to embark upon in our private lives, in our professional lives, in everything that we assume. But it's unthinkable to most people. They can't believe the enormity of change that is now confronting them. Not in 50 or 60 years, but maybe 50 or 60 months. That is why unthinkable is still very appropriate for all that I'm trying to raise with you.
Thank you, Nick. Very interesting. We'll come back to the issue of climate change and COP26 in a few minutes, because you were there in Glasgow, and I am very interested in your observations and insights. But let me come to this question in a slightly different way. You have been meeting and talking and interacting with global leaders during much of your career, your distinguished career as a journalist. And I'd like you to comment a little bit on what you see as the sort of defining characteristics of effective leadership. And in your view, as you contemplate the international landscape, we have 193 member countries of the United Nations. So we have 193 prime ministers or heads of state. Are they ready to confront the myriad catastrophic risks that cast a shadow over our future? Do you feel comfortable with the quality of leadership that we have in the world today? And if not, what can we do about it?
On balance, no. But I think leadership has woken up. Some of it has been pretty brave, I think, during the COVID crisis, and helped by science as well. But there's an ultimate paradox and conflict and tension, Augusto, here, which is that the nature of what has to be confronted goes against the spirit of the electoral cycle, of the way politicians in non-authoritarian countries get elected to power, and therefore the way in which they should be leading is elusive, because what is needed goes against the functional relationship between them and the politics or the corporate sector in which they are working. Because the scale of challenge now is so enormous that to do what is necessary is essentially unpopular. And if you're a politician, you want to get elected or re-elected. And therefore, as I heard a very senior German diplomat say, what we need now is leaders who are prepared to commit suicide, political suicide, in order to get the right things done. It's the same in the corporate sector as well, particularly in publicly quoted companies. If you're a chief executive or a member of a C-suite, you've got to actually do what the board want, what the shareholders want. That is now changing, but you've got to be prepared to take risks and go against certainly the Milton Friedman principles, which I think are dead in the water now. And I'd be saying they were dying if you were asking me 2 or 3 years ago. The Milton Friedman principles of only serving shareholders. We're seeing a dramatic change, and it's happening virtually by the day, by the week, where those at the top are having to realize that the people they serve and the interests they serve are not just the shareholders. And I think you can see that with what happened, particularly with Exxon, back earlier in 2021, when one of the vested interests, shareholder groups, managed to force a change on the board. And I use that as an example because the chief executive fought amazingly hard to prevent those new appointees being made and new appointments being made to the board. So there's a conflict between the leadership and the role that you have as a leader and the new obligations, and it's changing very quickly. I think public opinion, the view of customers, clients, people who pay for services and for goods, is changing fast. there's a new imperative, there's a new series of impediments as well. And therefore, what makes a good leader is someone who understands this, reflects this, and is prepared to take large numbers of people with him. We do a case study in our book, Thinking the Unthinkable, about the bank in Singapore, DBS, where Piyush Gupta, who's been now chief executive for almost 10 years, he said, I knew what had to be done. This is the Development Bank of Singapore, a very boring bank, but has now become very successful, very aggressive, very willing and able to engage the public and also the customers and also its shareholders, because he joined from another bank. He realized he had to get the board on board. He had to get the staff on board. He had to get everyone on board. And as a result, he changed the culture, the mindset, and the ability of a bank to change the way it does things to the satisfaction of those they're serving, even though those who they're serving and those who he is serving maybe didn't quite realize what they wanted. So leadership is brutal. The realities are now, the realities of pressure are brutal. But those who are going to survive are those who are going to be nimble and agile and reflect the enormity of change and take people with them, whether it be customers, whether it be clients, whether it be stakeholders, whether it be shareholders, whether it be the voters. Take them with them. That's a big ask. It's a big challenge.
Yeah. You know, I find your comment about the sort of the short-term focus of our political leadership being at odds with the kinds of decisions which need to be taken, for instance, to address climate change, which essentially have very much to do with the longer term. And you can see this, for instance, in the reluctance to accept carbon taxes, which economists have been saying is one of the most effective tools to deal with climate change, because they are unpopular, because they carry political costs, which brings us to your comment about, you know, leaders that are willing to commit political suicide.
I'm quoting a senior public servant talking about what is needed and the dramatic nature of what is needed by leaders. And can I just comment on one thing you just said, Augusto? I don't think that the challenge of the climate emergency, and I'm using the word emergency, not just change, is a long-term issue. It is short-term. It's short-term by the standards that many of us think and live by. We're talking about 5 or 6 years for dramatic change towards net zero, not 2040, 2050, 2060. We're talking about dramatic change, which has got to be implemented in everything that we do and how we do it.
I absolutely agree. You know, soon after COP26, one of my favorite columnists in the Financial Times used a very interesting expression to sort of characterize COP26. He said, groundless optimism and empty pledges, which I thought was a nice way to capture, you know, some of the news coming out of the event, although perhaps slightly on the negative side. Nevertheless, as an economist, to me, it has been obvious already for many years that the current system that we have, you know, to address climate change is not working, right? I mean, if you just look at the numbers, you know, we came out of Paris in 2015 with pledges which were not binding, which when you added them up, they were inconsistent with the temperature thresholds that were agreed upon and so on. So this has led some scientists to basically question the whole process. Emissions are on the rise, which is exactly the opposite of what we're looking for. And so is this perhaps an instance of something that we could call a kind of a failure in our sort of global governance framework, that we don't have the right institutions, we don't have the right incentives. Whatever we do is very ad hoc. We are proceeding in a very chaotic and disorganized way. And the end result is that we are at increasing risk of catastrophic rise in temperatures with all that will bring about. And so what is the solution? How can we steer this ship in a better direction that will actually deliver the kinds of results that we want that are consistent with some measure of security and prosperity in coming decades.
I think I read that column as well, and it was questioning as well whether the UN process can ever produce the kind of dramatic changes that are needed. I think it is very straightforward to be able to dismiss in a rather scornful way the kind of process you saw at COP26, highlighted by the brinkmanship, particularly in the last couple of days. I don't think it was a failure, COP26. We are talking here about essentially an existential threat to our planet. I certainly privately, having listened to the IPCC, having listened to Johan Rockström of the Potsdam Institute, having seen the evidence produced by Sir David King, the former chief scientist of the United Kingdom, I'm not prepared to give any kind of slack to the idea that maybe we're being over pessimistic about what is happening. I say that because I think this is why we can call it unthinkable or unpalatable. The science is making very clear that for the time being, as Johan Rockström said and says, we are now beyond planetary boundaries. The planet cannot in any way accommodate the way in which we are abusing the planet. And that was confirmed as well by the Partha Dasgupta report commissioned by the UK Treasury, which published at the beginning of February, in which he said, look, nature is being taken for granted, is not even considered as an externality in costs for business and all that we assume in the way we run our lives. But when you look at what is now happening, and there is a view, a strong view, which I'm prepared to believe, which is that the tipping points which we were fearing would happen quite soon have now been passed. And therefore, we are creating new tipping points. And that is hastening the speed at which we are getting closer, not to 1.5 degrees, but 2.4, 2.7 degrees, maybe even higher than that. And we've therefore got to take dramatic action because we are abusing the planet. David Attenborough, the brilliant naturalist who has been a leading voice in so much of this, remarkable in his mid-90s, the energy and the perception he's got. But he went a year ago to Chernobyl and stood in Pripyat, which is the town next to the Chernobyl reactor, which was evacuated 2 days after the disaster in April 1986. And he said, look, this place is overgrown by vegetation. It's occupied by animals. Human beings are not here anymore. And one of the reasons why, of course, that was such a disaster is the Soviets did not believe that their RBMK reactors could actually explode in that way. They didn't believe there was a risk, or that they believed as well that their resilience for the RBMK untested was quite adequate. Well, I went there at the beginning of October, partly encouraged by David Attenborough, and it is deeply, deeply chilling, because what you're seeing is part of our planet, which is simply can't be occupied now because of the violation of nature and the fact that there is now a reactor. Reactor number 4 is encased in steel and concrete, paid for partly by the European Union. And all it can do is maybe restrict the radiation for another 100 years. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years. And so the reason I'm using that example is to say, I don't think we can take a risk that actually things are going to be okay. This is just a blip. This is not a blip. This is now a profound threat to the way we live on our planet. And it is not climate change. It is a climate emergency. When you look at what's happening to the Arctic, when you look at what's happening to the Eskimo communities, literally the houses that they've been living in for tens of years are being washed away because the sea level is rising. And the same is happening in Bangladesh. I don't have to go through all of this, but there is enough evidence to say with glaciers, with snow melt and everything else, everything that we've taken for granted cannot be taken for granted. I can say that sitting here in Southwest London. I now believe that where I'm living, I shouldn't be living. because actually it's a flood risk, which means I probably won't have a safe house, which probably means I can't get insurance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Much of everything I've taken for granted is no longer guaranteed. Now, you may think that this is a rant, Augusto, but it's not. You've got to look at the evidence. And even if we've been through COVID and been through the upset of COVID, that is only a foretaste of what we're now facing in even greater quantities, with even greater tenacity, with even greater threat from the climate emergency, which we can control if we do the right things and accept we've got to change our lifestyle at the same time. This is not about tree hugging. It's about understanding it's affecting every kind of assumption we make about the kind of life we will be able to live. And you're a senior economist. Even the economics of our world are under challenge now because of the basis on which economics tends to be judged is no longer guaranteed.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I don't at all think that this is a rant, Nick. I think that you are raising very fundamental issues, and it is absolutely clear to me that we are facing global catastrophic risks. Climate change is obviously perhaps the most preeminent of those, but we have others. I mean, the rising militarism that you see in the world today, the increasing tensions between the two superpowers, the fact that you see vast amounts of resources being deployed, you know, to modernize our weapon systems, that there is a risk that we might see malignant uses of technology, you know, in the area of weapons, killer robots, artificial viruses, and so on. All of these are sources of concern, obviously.
I agree.
As an economist, I am perturbed by some of the trends that I see. For 30 years, we had seen a gradual, steady reduction in the numbers of extremely poor people in the world. There is a specific definition used by the World Bank of $1.90 of income per day. And, you know, that number came down from a couple of billion in 1990 to about 750 million in 2019. Well, the latest figures from the World Bank suggest that there has been a massive reversal in 2020. We have increased the ranks of the extremely poor by probably upwards of 100 million people, which means that probably Sustainable Development Goal number one, which is the cornerstone of the SDGs, the elimination of extreme poverty by 2030, is most likely out of reach. So, yes, I agree with you. We have very, very serious concerns, and I agree. Maybe we should no longer call it climate change. We should call it a climate emergency.
Could I just add to that and say that I think, and this is an extreme way of expressing what I think is happening, I think you are now seeing potentially the hollowing out of societal stability. And therefore, national security is not about national defense. It's also about how governments are going to ensure stability internally against a complete recalibration of economic structures and where wealth is, where wealth is not, and how people are going to earn money. And I think it's going to change very quickly. Yes, there will be a green revolution, but this is not just about Africa. It's not just about migration. It's not just about the migration from the Middle East and so on. This is potentially about how our political leaders and corporate leaders are going to maintain civil stability within their own countries. And therefore, national security is as much about how you keep your country quiescent, which is why we say not just thinking the unthinkable, but thinking the unpalatable, because actually no one can really envision. We can see already what's happening with the anti-vaccination riots and upset. Those numbers are not yet big, but they could develop into something much bigger. So I'm putting a lot on the table here for you, Augusto, but I can't say with any guarantee that this is the way it's going to be. But I think those are things that leaders need now to be mindful of. These are significant risks, which are not necessarily on risk registers, but they need to be, because otherwise there will be ghastly shocks at some point, a bit like what happened in 2008, when people kind of knew it was going to happen but didn't want to talk about it. we're at the same position now with the stability of society, not just because of COVID, but imminently because of climate too.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I agree. I think we need to rethink entirely the whole concept of national security. I think so far our concept of national security has been unduly focused on military preparedness, on, you know, modernizing our weapon systems, having the latest aircrafts and so on. And yet in 2020, you could have hundreds, if not thousands, of nuclear weapons, and they were completely useless in the face of COVID-19. So maybe national security now has to be reframed in terms of having public health infrastructures that will withstand the next pandemic, in terms of having resources that we can use to educate our kids and our young people to the emerging complex global economy and so on. So yeah, I think you're touching on very fundamental issues. But you mentioned the latest protests again against vaccine mandates and so on. And so let me shift gears a little bit. And, you know, you predicted what we call and label fake news all the way back in 2009 in Sky Full of Lies and Black Swans, your peer review study for the Reuters Institute at Oxford. Now, this term has come to be incredibly widespread, as we have all realized how harmful and dangerous misinformation in the last few years has become. What factors have contributed to the rise and the prevalence of fake news? How do you think we can address this problem, if at all? And obviously, this has a bearing on climate change as well. Climate change deniers very often are acting on the basis of fake news, right?
I hate the term fake news. I think Donald Trump invented it in order to get political advantage. I think it has completely distorted the reality of what I was identifying back in 2009. And I'll explain that in a moment. But I think too often, particularly the politicians and leaders of a certain kind, if they hear something they don't like, they just call it fake news, as if calling it fake news discredits it, even if it's accurate. Let me just be clear what I was saying in 2009, and I wrote a book called Sky Full of Lies and Black Swans. Sky Full of Lies came from Myanmar when there were protests in the streets, and it was the first generation of digital cameras. And you could see that what was happening in Myanmar, in Rangoon, in Mandalay, and you saw people being killed. And the material in those days was uplifted eventually, not immediately, and it wasn't live like on FaceTime or on WhatsApp. And the Burmese government, the Myanmar government, said at the United Nations, it's not happening. None of these protests are happening. Our country is calm. What you're seeing on television is a sky full of lies. It's a great, great phrase, but it was completely disrespectful of the reality of what was happening. You had people with the first generation of mobile phones and electronic and digital cameras who were able to record and upload and therefore inform people about what was really going on. And black swans, of course, don't really happen unless you're in Australia and New Zealand. And what I was trying to identify was warning about what we've now been through. But most people, again, thought I was nuts. I was trying to identify what was likely to happen and what was going to be the new vulnerability of power, politics, and systems from the new digital environment. And this was really before much of the digital and social media, which we take for granted now, had even emerged. It was just the creation of instant reporting, instant perceptions, instant confirmation of what was going on. And how it would be impossible for governments and corporates to think that they can rectify and literally marginalize the images and the reporting that was going on. I said, you have got to realize your authority and your assumption of supremacy of information, that is going to fail and it will die. Now, what it's developed, of course, in recent years is an ability to manipulate and to counter. But what I was identifying in those days, Augusto, was very clear: the vulnerability of power, politics, and systems from the new gizmos that we all had in our hands or would have at some point in the future. And I couldn't predict Facebook, and I couldn't predict WhatsApp, and I couldn't predict so many things like Signal and Telegram and so on. But look at the proliferation and the ability to communicate, whether you're in government to avoid the public knowing what you've been saying to your minister, you can do it on a private circuit, or whether you're a counter-revolutionary or someone who's mounting street protests against a government. All that has now created a fantastic liberation on information. But I come back to what I said to you 2 or 3 minutes ago. I think the idea that this is fake news is completely misleading and a complete distortion of the reality of what is happening. Fake news is a label used by people who want to discredit information, even though it's correct and being reported in the new social media environment.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing those insights, Nick. I am remembering that Amanda Ellis, who is a former New Zealand ambassador to the United Nations, gave a talk a few months ago in which she made a very fascinating observation, which I think is fully backed up by the data. She said that some of the more successful cases of management of COVID in places like New Zealand and Norway and Finland and Iceland and Denmark and Singapore and Taiwan and so on, were in nations that were actually run by women. The prime minister or the head of state was a woman. And people who have studied sort of management of COVID in this kind of leadership, you know, have seen that they tended to be tended to make decisions on the basis of scientific evidence. They tended to be quite open and transparent in their dealings with the public, admitting mistakes when mistakes were made, and in general, sort of an approach that was conciliatory and collaborative. And a statistic came out of this debate that was quite interesting, which said something like, 40% of all the, women account for 11% of all the prime ministers and heads of state, but they account for 40% of the successful cases of management of COVID. I'm mentioning this by way of asking you whether perhaps one of the problems that we have in the world today is that women are not sufficiently sort of empowered, both economically and politically. You know, there is masses of evidence that suggests that, for instance, when you have greater participation of women in parliament, greater participation of women on corporate boards of you know, publicly listed companies and so on, good things happen. I'm not going to go into the details, but take my word for it. I could give you many examples of the kinds of good things that happen when we see a greater presence of women in decision making. So you've been around more than three decades talking to leaders, to business heads, to prime ministers and heads of state. Tell us, what do you think of this?
It's not a question I've specifically asked, or we've specifically asked with our data gathering. But I think it's remarkable, and I have no reason in any way to challenge anything that the ambassador said, Amanda Ellis said. But when you look at Finland, when you look at Slovakia, when you look at Estonia, when you look at Nkosi, who's just taken over recently back in July at the World Trade Organization, who you will know from the World Bank, you will know her formidable, quite apart from her extraordinary and wonderful clothing that she wears, her colors and so on. She lightens up a room, but she has been formidable in many ways, including as foreign minister of Nigeria. I think there was one blip. And I've enjoyed enormously dealing with her over the years. When she says to me, Nick, what are you going to ask me now? Are you going to cause me trouble? But I much enjoy dealing with women in leadership, not just political leadership, but in corporate leadership. But I think there's a danger in this, and this is where I'm not aiming to get myself into trouble, that somehow it's felt that women have somehow an extra level of intuition and knowledge and tactic and strategy, which allows them to overcome some of the realities that politically they can face or financially they can face. And I think there's a danger of assuming that the appointment of a woman will make a difference in a way that a man wouldn't. So I caution on that front. But I tell you one of the very interesting things which I've yet to get to the bottom of, frankly. I go, like you, I think, to a lot of conferences. Obviously, I didn't during lockdown. And one of the things I complain about, even as a male, white-haired now, tragically, I complain that there's not enough diversity, both in skin color and also in gender. And time after time, and I partially believe them, I'm told that many women turn down requests, invitations to appear on panels or to speak at conferences. Now, I think there's an element of family duties and wanting to keep weekends sacrosanct and so on. But it is a serious problem, because too often I find myself being, when I'm moderating, I'm facing three or four men, or most of them in dark suits, most of them with a tie, even though I encourage them to dress down a bit. And I keep saying, where are the women? And there's still something which I have not put my finger on, which is identified as a reluctance of women to engage publicly. Yet, I've been at conferences where women have been the stars. They've been intuitive. They've been frank. They've been far less protective about things which men tend to be coy about. And so I say to myself, why are so many of them reluctant, particularly if they get to positions of power and responsibility? But broadly, I fully agree with everything you've just said and Amanda Ellis said. And obviously, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand has been remarkable. And she's become a mother while in power, and she's been re-elected. And that's difficult for any politician to do, especially a woman. And you have to respect her for it, not least when she says, sorry, or we made a mistake. And that's something which I think from our work is beginning to be accepted by a lot more leaders, whether men or women.
You know, you address a very interesting question. One possible reason for the reluctance and the absence at times, you know, of more women in positions of power and responsibility may have to do with something that we discovered at the World Bank over many, many years, which is that 90% of all the countries in the world have something like 1,600 different kinds of discriminations embedded in the law of their respective countries, which make it difficult for her to access the job market, which undermine her property rights, which limit her in multiple ways, you know, from essentially rising and making her contribution to decision making, to prosperity, and so on. So there is that kind of sort of historical legacy, which unfortunately we're still living through. But Nick, let me ask you perhaps a concluding question. And this is something that sometimes we have asked some of our other guests, which basically has with the role of young people. As you know, in Glasgow, many of the people who are out in the streets protesting and pushing leaders to be more ambitious and to take climate change more seriously were young people, because everybody understands they will bear the brunt of what's coming in coming decades. Political leaders in their 60s and 70s are not going to be around, you know, to see the tragedy unfolding, I don't think. And so what do you say, you know, with all your experience and the many years you have been traveling around the world and looking at these problems, what do you say to young people so that they will not become cynical, so that they will not lose hope, so that they will become energized and to do the kinds of things that people like Jody Williams did in the 1990s, when as a housewife, she basically, you know, networked with civil society organizations and eventually delivered a treaty on banning landmines. This was not something that was started by some senior politicians. It was something that came from civil society. In fact, at that time, probably a young woman herself. So to conclude, share some words of encouragement for our young people. Thousands and thousands of the followers of the Global Governance Forum are actually people under 30.
The next generation are our conscience. And my goodness, it was wonderful in Glasgow. I witnessed a lot of it, 100,000 on the streets in the first Saturday, Nature Day. Fantastic. Actually, there were a lot of elderly people as well, or older people, or I don't know how you discriminate these days. It doesn't matter what the age is. They are the conscience for the future. They are creating new pressure. Fridays for Future has been a remarkable has had a remarkable impact. And let me tell you, in Glasgow, and I was there for more than 2 weeks, it was remarkable the number of delegates and those inside, among the 40,000 who were inside the whole conference area, who went out in the final days to join the protesters. I think the message has got through. And certainly we in our Thinking the Unthinkable work, we make it very clear. 4 years ago, when we did our main work and warned about what was coming, we had two forewords. One by Lord Nick Stern of climate change, and also another one by a 25-year-old, to make the point that the next generation have to be listened to and their concerns have to be taken care of. We were well ahead of the trend. I think politicians are beginning to get this. I think the corporate sector is certainly getting this, certainly among when they realize the power that there is now of the next generation to literally boycott a company, either in the way they do business, what they buy from the company, or indeed internally. And I chaired in Glasgow a remarkable two-handed discussion between a 55-year-old managing director of a large engineering firm and a 23-year-old who just joined the company. And it was a remarkable, they were doing this publicly in front of an audience. And she confirmed, the 23-year-old, exactly what I expected her to say, that, you know, if my company does not listen to us and our concerns and the way and the standards and the emotions and the expectations we have of them as a company, we'll all get up and walk. We're not going to stick around in a company like this. And when there's a tight labor market, this is going to become even more problematic. So what I do see is an adaptability among a lot of corporate leaders and less so politicians so far to realize that this is about their own future. And if they don't actually embrace the next generation, their concerns, and the fact that the next generation does not want to have the horror of the climate emergency dumped on them as if to say, we've had our good times, you get on with it. I think you raise an absolutely vital and core part of the existential challenge for all of us, which is to recognize that the next generation, I'm talking about people up to 30 or 40, they deserve to be listened to. They've got to be listened to more carefully. When Greta Thunberg said in Glasgow, and it's become a kind of her calling card, there was too much blah, blah, blah inside. Well, it makes good headlines, but it's actually become something which we can all refer to. There was a lot of blah, blah, blah in Glasgow, but my goodness, there was a lot of listening and recognition, both of diversity, of age, and also generations which have to be listened to in many parts of the world, not just in the developed world, but in the developing world as well, with the indigenous people. I saw change there, even though it wasn't remarked upon too publicly. I saw remarkable change in attitudes, and the next generation is core to that. And those at the top who want to somehow think they can get away because they know better at the age of 55 or 60, they are going to have a rude awakening. And I hope they do if they ignore the next generation.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.